Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Continuing with our Conversations with Remarkable Minds series, the topic, the revolt of the deep state on the White House and the deep state's expansion to the private capitalist sector. My guest, Professor Peter Dale Scott. He is a former professor of English, University of California, Berkeley, where he also was the co-founder of the Peace and Conflict Studies Program. He's a recognized national poet, a former Canadian diplomat, and a scholar. He is the author on the domestic and international political issues, including taxation, war and conflict, the war on drugs, the politics of oil, and the assassination of JFK. His life work is focused on his theory of deep politics, a descriptive, realistic way to objectively understand the evidence of coercive, unelected government, non-accountable to the American public, which would otherwise be characterized as conspiratorial in the mainstream media. He is the author of many books, including The American Deep State, Wall Street, Big Oil, and The Attack on U.S. Democracy, and more recently, Dallas 63, the first deep state revolt against the White House that looks at the activities of the CIA, the FBI, and other entities behind the JFK assassination, and how this trend has continued through the last part of the Iran-Contra scandal, 9/11, and beyond. His website is peterdalescott.net. Nice to have you with us today.
I'm glad to be back.
There's been a vast body of information and documents and books published to thoroughly discredit the Warren Commission report that concluded Lee Harvey Oswald was a lone gunman and there was no larger conspiracy behind the JFK assassination. The Commission's report has now been fully debunked by many excellent independent researchers and journalists, including yourself. You offer a different spin by interpreting the parties behind the JFK murders as an entity of individuals and interests with their own agenda, not in the best interest of the American public or democracy, that you call the deep state. And this deep state is a kind of shadow government of sorts that is unelected, non-accountable by the rule of law that exists within the American government and various federal agencies. One of the words you use to speak of the assassination of JFK is revolt, that the murder of President Kennedy were a deep event, was the deep state's first revolt against the White House. And one of the primary things to look for in solving modern crimes are the primary interests the parties have that motivate them to commit a crime. So if the JFK assassination marks a high point of the deep state in controlling the White House, what were the deep state's primary interests held that would require them to get rid of a president and whose interests were ultimately being served? The forum is yours.
Well, I would begin by saying that I don't think we should have too structured or organized a notion of the deep state. So there were, I believe, a multitude of reasons why various people working together were dissatisfied with Kennedy. I think some of the reasons had to do with foreign policy. Kennedy, you know, in his last year of his presidency, had taken some remarkable steps to normalize relations with the Soviet Union. He had actually concluded a treaty with the Soviet Union, and that sounds pretty normal now, but at the time, many people said, no, you cannot sign treaties with the Soviet Union because they're atheists and they can't be trusted. And this was, in fact, the first treaty that had been signed with the Soviet Union since the Austrian Peace Treaty back in 1955. When I talk about the deep state, I think of it as having different layers. What makes it very urgent now is the growth of agencies, mostly since World War II. The CIA is the most talked about, perhaps, but also NSA now, the National Security Agency, is finally getting the headlines it deserves. For a long time, it was hardly mentioned. And these are structures. These are actual agencies that have been set up by the government. The CIA was set up by statute. The NSA was not set up by a statute. And there are others that people have heard about, perhaps less, the Joint Special Operations Command in the Pentagon. There are a number of them. And then behind them, they do a lot of contracting out. We have a huge intelligence budget, but it isn't all spent inside the government. A lot is contracted to another level of the deep state, agencies like Booz Allen Hamilton or SAIC. These are very rarely in the headlines. Well, Booz Allen Hamilton finally got a lot of press when one of their employees, Edward Snowden, decided to defect and go public with an updated version of the Pentagon Papers scandal. But they something like 70% of the intelligence budget, which of course is a secret budget, is outsourced. And so these people are very powerful, and in some ways almost more powerful than the agencies that contract with them. You know, the path of promotion is to do a stretch in the CIA and then quit the CIA, take a much better paying job with, say, Booz Allen. And these people have no accounting whatsoever. But they're not just powerful because they're connected to the CIA. They also do business with particularly multinational corporations. And this is where the oil companies come in. The real links between the oil companies and the CIA are through these agencies with that have contracted with the CIA, but at the same time are doing business and profiting from their relations with the oil companies. So we're getting a whole the deeper you go into this, the more diffuse it becomes and the harder to define. And for me, as you gave the subtitle of my book, The American Deep State, Wall Street, Big Oil, and the Attack on U.S. Democracy, I do believe that if you go behind Booz Allen Hamilton, you come to the oil companies who have much more influence on our politics than the press usually acknowledges. You have to remember that the media depend on the oil companies for advertising income, so they're not likely to be extremely critical in looking at what the oil companies are doing. And then behind them, ultimately, you get Wall Street, by which I mean both the banks and financial institutions that invest in these companies, but also, just as important, the law firms. Like I talk in my book a lot about Sullivan and Cromwell, which was the firm that both Dulles brothers, Allen Dulles and John Foster Dulles, came out of. And they, in the 50s, John Foster Dulles was Secretary of State, Allen Dulles was head of the CIA. Both of them were partners on leave from Sullivan and Cromwell, which had been having that kind of influence in the American government, really, since the firm was first set up decades before. So the deep state has got many levels to it, and at the top, I would say it's not structured at all. It's just people know each other. Wall Street is people belong to the same clubs. There was a time when the very early years of the CIA, they were people who belonged to the New York Social Register. A lot of them were from inherited wealth, had ancestors who were part of the establishment. That was certainly true of the Dulles brothers. It's certainly true of Richard Helms that I've written about recently, because his grandfather had been head of the Bank of International Settlements in Geneva, which is the very pinnacle of what you might call the international deep state. So it gets smaller and tighter at the very top, but also not very hard to define because it doesn't have any charter or terms of agreement that I know of, at any rate. I think it's just a group of people who, partly by inheritance, have been in control of the country for a very long time.
Keeping with the JFK assassination for a moment, please. Testimonies of government officials during the Warren Commission were simply lies and excluded information that would likely contradict the actual facts pointing to a conspiracy, such as whether or not Lee Harvey Oswald was in fact in Mexico City and the multiple intelligence files on Oswald, which were not all submitted as evidence. And Richard Helms, that you just mentioned, who later went on to head the CIA, was a key figure in presenting misinformation to the commission. And all this suggests there was already in place a sophisticated counterintelligence operation developed among the groups making up the deep state. What is alarming is that there were numerous intelligence failures during the lead-up to the assassination, and no senior CIA official was ever held responsible. Would you speak on that, and do you see this as an analogous to 9/11 in the 9/11 Commission hearings?
Well, I'd like to begin with that last question first, because it helps, I think, to establish the right context for looking at this. Yes, I believe that we learn more about the Kennedy assassination if we study 9/11, and vice versa. I think we understand 9/11 better if we look at the Kennedy assassination, and I would throw some other events in there, too, at Watergate particularly, Iran-Contra, and one which never really made it into the mainstream press, but was, I think, very important, something what we call the October Surprise back in 1980, which was a Republican stratagem, some people say a treasonous stratagem, to prevent Carter from being reelected as president by dealing secretly with the Iranians who were holding Americans hostage at that time. And the deal was not to release the hostages as long as Carter was president. And that's what actually happened. The hostages were released hours after Reagan was sworn in as president. I call all those events I've just mentioned, JFK, Watergate, the October Surprise, Iran-Contra, and 9/11, they all have features in common. They have far more features in common than most people know. And I call them all deep events. And the first thing that that term defines about them is they are major events which we never get to the bottom of. You know, Watergate, they had an enormous report at the end. The president resigned, so that there was consequences, but volumes and volumes of hearings published. But it began with the question, why did five people, some of them CIA veterans, go break into the Democratic National Committee headquarters in the Watergate building? That question was never answered. We still don't know. It was the initial question, and we learned a great deal about other things that Nixon had done, but we never really learned anything about that. And that's true of the Kennedy assassination. I've studied for 40 years. I don't know, to this day, who killed President Kennedy. I'm very certain of something you referred to, and that is that there was a cover-up, that people lied. In the case of Helms, I've argued recently committed perjury. Almost worse than perjury, obstruction of justice. He did things to make sure that the Warren Commission would not gain necessary information about the relationship of the CIA to Lee Harvey Oswald. But that's about all we know. 9/11, maybe we can talk. There's some very precise analogies between...
Please go into that in detail.
Well, one of the ones that I had to talk about in this article is that shortly, you know, the CIA maintained a file, at least two files, on Lee Harvey Oswald, and one of them, his so-called 201 file, had been pretty dormant for a year and a half after he came back from the Soviet Union, and then suddenly, just weeks, 5 or 6 weeks before the Kennedy assassination, it goes active, and there is a series of cables sent in and out of the CIA headquarters about Lee Oswald. And the thrust of one of them was that this is, and you referred to this. There was a report that came into headquarters from Mexico City that a Lee Oswald had contacted the Soviet embassy in Mexico City, and it's a bit complex, but it. The thrust of the cable was that he'd been in contact with a man called Kostikov, in Valery Kostikov, in the embassy. Well, the name of Valery Kostikov was well known in Washington. The debate was going on. There was no debate that he was a KGB agent. So you have a Lee Oswald in contact with a KGB agent, that's the content of the cable. But more than that, there was speculation in Washington that he was both the FBI and the CIA, that he was actually part of what they call Division 13 in the KGB, which was the Division of Wet Affairs, Mokshiyajela, by which they mean assassinations. Well, I mean, this is certainly relevant that the CIA had cables talking about Lee Oswald, who will soon be designated the killer of President, you know, weeks later. He's front page headlines as the alleged killer of the president, and here are cables saying he'd been in touch with a KGB agent who is suspected of being in charge of assassinations. Now, that allegation is absolutely central, I'm certain, most people are certain, it's central to how the assassination was constructed and also the key to why there was a cover-up. Because, first of all, it wasn't true, but some people were saying it was true, and if that had gone public, there would have been a lot of pressure to react against the Soviet Union, and that would have been World War III, and the Pentagon estimate of casualties of what would happen with a nuclear war against the Soviet Union at that point was 600 million casualties. Well, Johnson worked with a lower figure. He worked with a figure of, I think, 40 million casualties, but this became a primary reason for creating the Warren Commission. Johnson used this argument. He twisted the arm of Chief Justice Warren, who said, I'm the Chief Justice. I shouldn't be in a government commission. And Johnson said, you got to do this and stop a situation where 40 million people can be killed. Well, all of that, if you wanted to solve the case, you would have had to go into the circumstances of this cable and how it was treated in Washington. And this is where we're going to come to the analogy with 9/11, because when this information came into Washington, the CIA notified the FBI. Of course, they should. But they didn't notify the FBI about Kostikov. They said that there was a Lee Oswald who had contacted the embassy. They totally suppressed the name of Kostikov. The name of Kostikov was far more important here than the name of Lee Oswald, but especially in 5 weeks before he was known to have done anything on, or accused of doing anything on the level of killing the president. But they suppressed that information, and I think I know why they did, because let's just say, first of all, well, clearly, it's part of a CIA-authorized operation, and It's in the category of what the CIA called LC Improve. And by LC Improve, they mean counterintelligence operations against the Soviet Union. All the LC cryptonyms are always operations, like LC Flutter, for example, is when you're going to do a lie detector test on somebody. So there was an operation, and let's just say, before we think about the assassination, why would they suppress the name of Kostikov and the cable to the FBI? And the reason is, I think they didn't want Oswald being put on the security list that the FBI maintained. Because let's assume, and this part is very fuzzy to me, but the most likely thing, I think, is that the CIA has authorized an operation that is in Mexico City, involves the name, not the man, because I don't think, well, I'm sure it wasn't the real Lee Harvey Oswald, and I can, I think, prove that if you are interested. But they're using the name Lee Oswald in an operation. They don't want the FBI to start shadowing this Lee Oswald, so they don't want to trip all the alarm systems by mentioning Kostikov. Now, when you think of whether some of the people, I think, who are doing this, not all of them, but it would only need to be one or two of the CIA people doing this, and I must say I suspect Mr. Angleton, James Angleton, the head of CIA counterintelligence. Many people, for different reasons, do this. He's certainly in charge of the cover-up after the assassination. But he may also have been one of those who were involved in the assassination. And it's even more crucial for the assassination plot to succeed. Here now you've designated a culprit. Lee Harvey Oswald is going to be the culprit. And the bigwigs in Dallas engineer the parade route so that it'll go right by the school book depository where he works. And they want him to be the alleged culprit, the designated culprit. But for that, he mustn't be on the security index, because if he's on the security index, then the FBI would be keeping track of where he was. He might have been under surveillance. The Secret Service would have been warned about him, and then they would have had extra guards at the school book depository. It's just shocking, frankly, that there was nothing done about that building. That was the most sensitive point in the whole parade route, and the Secret Service wasn't there. If Oswald had been on the security index, of course they would have been there, and then he couldn't have been the designated culprit. So that's a very long explanation about Oswald, and now let's talk about 9/11.
Please give us the details and examples.
In the case of 9/11?
Yes, please.
Well, you have designated culprits again in the case of 9/11. This case, 19 hijackers, alleged hijackers, I want to say. I'm not very clear on the details, but I know there are a lot of signs of cover-up. One is it's just like this: within 15 minutes of the assassination of Kennedy, they put out a description of the person they were looking for as the killer, and they said a man with 5'10" and 165 pounds. Well, that is not actually the weight and height of Oswald. He weighed more like 141 and was 5'9". But it is exactly the height and weight of Oswald in his FBI file and the height and weight of Oswald in his CIA file. So they did that within 15 minutes. And the same speed of identifying the culprits happened in 9/11, and I mean, it's extraordinary that before the last of the four planes went down to the ground on September the 11th, 2001, the FBI put out a list of the alleged hijackers. Now, in fact, it's not the ultimate list. The first list they put out had somebody on it who was dead. They amended that very quickly, and that is being forgotten about. There was actually media evidence of it at first. But it was extraordinary that they had solved the case before the last of the planes hit the ground. That included the people who were on Flight 93, which was not yet identified as being... So the first similarity, and it's not the most important, but it is a striking one, that in both cases, they identified the designated culprit right away. And that's a reason for me to suspect that they had been decided in advance that these people were going to be their designated culprits. But much more ominously, just as we'd see the CIA taking steps to make sure that Oswald would not go on the security index in 1963, we also see something very similar happening, activities by the CIA in 2001. I have to go back to 2000, which is the year that two of the alleged hijackers came into the United States. One of them actually had a multiple entry visa, and they were already known to be high-level people in Al-Qaeda. So obviously the thing you do is tell the FBI, and the CIA should have told the FBI. And the CIA actually said in an internal memo that they had told the FBI, but they hadn't. And it was outrageous that they hadn't. And there was an FBI person in the little CIA office liaison who wanted to tell the FBI, and he wasn't allowed to tell the FBI. And people who've written about this, Lawrence Houston and... Anyway, there are books that have written about this, and the assumption is that they didn't tell the FBI because they were part of some kind of CIA operation, probably a joint operation with Saudi intelligence. It might have been, for example, the rather legitimate purpose trying to penetrate Al-Qaeda in the United States. And so these two Al-Qaeda people were double agents. This is an explanation. We don't know. It's a certainty. That they could have been double agents working for the CIA at the same time they were in the FBI. But the striking thing is that they didn't tell the FBI until really just days before 9/11 itself. And here's another similarity, that just as the Oswald file had been dormant until just weeks before the assassination of Kennedy, so the files on these two Al-Qaeda agents, alleged hijackers, were dormant until just weeks, almost days, before the 9/11 occurred. And there was a lot of tension, because there were people in the FBI who knew something was going on, and they wanted to know what the CIA knew, and the CIA wouldn't tell them. And one FBI agent actually predicted 3 weeks before, he said, someday a lot of people are going to die because of this, and he said this just weeks before 9/11. So you have, in both cases, the deep event of JFK and the deep event of 9/11, you have designated culprits that are part of a CIA operation, and the FBI is not notified when it should have been notified. So this is a rather lengthy comparison I've made, but it's a very detailed comparison, and... there are other ways in which I could compare these two deep events to Watergate and Iran-Contra, but I'm just trying to give you an illustration of how, when you look beneath the surface and see how these things were handled by CIA headquarters, FBI headquarters, these two events that seem on the surface completely different turn out to have certain features in common. Hello?
Yes. I was listening. I thought you were going to add something there. In the past, and when even you look at the JFK assassination, all evidence about the existence of a deep state pointed primarily to powers within the government, the CIA, the military-industrial complex, that President Eisenhower warned about in 1959, the FBI and other federal factions also. However, today it appears that much of our government is influenced by outside powers, such as Wall Street and the large mega banking institutions, the fossil fuel industry, the private weapons manufacturers, and now private intelligence firms, perhaps even larger mega firms like Google, Facebook, Microsoft. Do we therefore need to expand our understanding of the deep state to include private corporations and the power elite outside of Washington?
Yes, from the very beginning, by the way, because one thing we haven't mentioned that's very relevant here is that the CIA was officially set up by the National Security Act in 1947, but it was a creation of Wall Street, and it was designed largely by Ellen Dulles and some other Wall Street figures. In New York, first of all, just to put pressure on the government, and then finally actually being designated by the government to design what an intelligence agency would look at. Truman was not very happy about this. He did this in response to pressures from Wall Street, which every government has always felt. But, and he tried very hard to make sure it would not be a Wall Street institution. If you look at all the directors, or a series of directors that Truman appointed, for first of all the Central Intelligence Group and then the Central Intelligence Agency, and they always came from the Midwest, like himself. But when you scratch below the level of the director and go to the deputy directors, I think six of the seven that we know about at the beginning were from Wall Street, and all but one of those six was also in the Social Register. So it was Wall Street's institution inside the government, and of course Wall Street was it's different from the banks and the rest of America because that was the center for international banking, and the CIA was to provide international intelligence and pretty soon international covert operations, which served the purposes of Wall Street banks and oil companies. I mean, that's a big charge I'm making, and you'd have to read my books, like The American War Machine, I think would be the one that tries to flesh that out. But there's absolutely no ambiguity that the CIA was very close to Wall Street, very close to the Council on Foreign Relations, which was a think Wall Street's think tank. And first of all, the think tank, the Council on Foreign Relations, says we have to do something about, we have to save United Fruit in Guatemala, and then the CIA begins to implement those plans. So the headquarters, in a way, of the CIA is not in Langley, but at a higher level in Wall Street. And you've added a lot of other big corporations. I would say that what's happened to this country, I think everybody has seen, one way of shortcutting the description is to say we've seen the rise in power of the 1%. Really, we should say the 0.1% of the 0.1% of the most wealthy people in America. And the headquarters for those people, of course, is Wall Street. And we have seen colossal mergers and concentrations of corporate organization. You've had also new wealth and new figures, Facebook, Microsoft, They didn't begin at Wall Street, but they do end up there, because when they become very big business and they capitalize, they sell stock, and it's done. This is where Wall Street becomes involved with them. And I don't want to say that the very rich plotted to make themselves richer, but I do want to say definitely that in the 1970s, after the Vietnam War was winding down, there was a huge debate as to whether the future of America should be as a civilian economy, cutting back on defense and building up its infrastructure and so on, versus the people who said, no, we need to maintain a global presence, and we have to keep our armed forces very big, and we have to keep our arms industry going. What you refer to as, you know, as Eisenhower referred to as the military-industrial complex. And in the 70s, the military-industrial complex won, and we did not go back to a civilian economy. We ended our longest war up to that time, but the result was not a demobilization of the army. No, we kept our armed forces up, and at the same time, that was a time of a lot of very radical protests against this system. It's a little hard to remember now because America was so different then. You had the SDS, you had the Black Liberation Movement, the Black Panthers, and so on. And you had this set off among the very rich a very defensive posture, saying, you know, we're under attack, and we have to fight back. And this is documented. There was something called the Powell Memorandum, which pointed out that, you know, the wealthy had a resource, which was wealth, and they should use wealth in politics. And there were certain foundations, or four of them particularly, the so-called Four Horsemen, pumped a huge amount of money into American politics, and you got things that looked like grassroots movements, but actually we call them astroturf movements, because they were there because they had been funded from above. And that defensive, those defensive moves to protect the rich were so successful that politics today is essentially politics controlled by the rich. And okay, Before we have the primaries that will begin this month, you have what's called the invisible primary, where candidates are selected by the very wealthy. And in the end, Americans will be allowed to choose between those who survive the invisible primary. This, for the first time, 2016, may be a bit different, because we, both the Democrats and the Republicans, have people who are there despite the invisible primary. Bernie Sanders is not somebody who's being picked by the very rich, and neither, for that matter, is Donald Trump, although he is very rich. These are people who've found their own ways to become serious candidates. But I can certainly say about the elections that we've had recently before them that 2008, for example, which was between Obama and McCain, and it, when, even before that, when you had Hillary as a candidate, all of these people had really been selected by above, particularly Obama. He was a freshman senator, and suddenly he's the presidential candidate. And, you know, the most important foreign policy decision at that time was what to do about Afghanistan, and all three of the candidates, the ones I've just mentioned, were all for going into Afghanistan. So the election was not, that wasn't up for grabs at the election at all. It had already been decided by the invisible primary. And so That's why we say that there's been an onslaught on American democracy, and I do believe that it begins with a series of deep events, of which the first was the Kennedy assassination.
Okay,
and
Dr. Scott.
Every one of these, I've written about this for years now.
Dr. Scott, let me suggest. Professor Scott, let me suggest some current events, and then I'd like your input on these. First, I'd like for you to take a look at Saudi Arabia.
Hello?
I'm wanting to get shorter answers from you, and I want to make it more germane to something today. I think you've done an outstanding job of laying out the deep state understanding to us. Now I want to see, from my perspective, and I'd like your response to it, whether or not you feel this is connected. For example, currently, right now, Saudi Arabia is without question the number one trainer of jihadists, al-Nusra, al-Qaeda, ISIS, ISIL. And then they bring in a goofball like John McCain, who says that these are moderates, and in point of fact, there are photographs of him meeting with some of the heads of ISIS. Then he goes back and gets the other dinosaurs in Congress to say, let's give them $500 million to train them. Of course, we say we're giving them non-offensive weapons, but we don't. We give them weapons, and that's one of the reasons that we didn't want anyone talking about the real reason that the attack upon the annex and the ambassador's office in Libya is because they were shipping weapons from Libya into Syria. Now we have a sovereign state that was not in conflict. There's more than enough evidence presented by credible people today and good quality journalists plus WikiLeaks that shows that the United States and its allies decided that they wanted a regime change in Syria. They wanted a regime change in Libya. They wanted to completely take down Iran. And to do that, they had to work with Israel on the one side and Turkey and where they have bases and Saudi Arabia on the other. We now know the following. We know that Saudi Arabia is training and offering enormous financing to virtually all the different radical jihadist groups that we are now saying that we're fighting. So to a lot of Americans historically, if you said communists, they wouldn't question it. They would say, all right, what do you have to do to get rid of communism over there? Or McCarthyism saying communism here. I have a list. Remember in West Virginia and I think it was Morgantown or Wheeling, I have a list of these communists or their sympathizers. And the average American would say, well, go after them. But today there are a group of us, you, myself, and probably 3,000 to 4,000 other progressive thinkers and researchers and investigators, journalists, who say, before we do something, let's look at the facts. You say that we're interested in stopping terrorism. Good. Then why don't you attack Saudi Arabia? Why don't you attack Turkey? Because those are the two number one and number two countries. Engage in this. You say that you want to turn off funding for ISIS. Well, why are there 12,000 tanker trucks lined up back to back in Syria going into Turkey, where the president of Turkey and his son will see that that is black marketed, a lot of it going back into Israel? We even now know the shipping company and the containers that they were using and how much they're paying per barrel, generally $20 a barrel. Then you don't touch one of those. In 14 months of trying to stop terrorism and the financing, you don't bomb one single one of those. Yet all your reconnaissance, satellites, drones cannot miss 14,000 trucks. It's not humanly possible, because Russia comes in and it shows the world photographs. It shows you miles and miles and miles of these, and it bombs them. And the United States gets really angry, because then we're told they're bombing the moderates. And Russia says, no, al-Nusra is a terrorist organization. whether or not they behead you or shoot you in the back of the head, you're dead either way if they get a hold of you, and they are going to make a theocracy out of Syria. And look at Libya. We did it in Libya, and look at it now. We tried to do it in Syria, and it would have long ago been over for Assad in Syria had Russia and Iran not come in. Now it's not humanly possible to get rid of Assad, and I believe that the people of Syria should vote to see whether or not they want him in office again. Virtually everything we've been told about Syria, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and you know the wealthiest nation on the planet?
Per capita is Qatar.
Yeah, it's Qatar. 107,000.
It's very important here, by the way. I mean, yes, what you've said about Saudi Arabia is true, but I think the main backer, Saudi Arabia's prime supporters are al-Nusra, not moderates, I agree. But ISIS is the protege primarily of Qatar. And this is a story that's an old story. It goes back to the period before 1990 when the CIA was actually training the people in America to go and be part of what became al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. And this is very much very central to my book, The American Deep State. I have chapters about the U.S. protection, FBI protection, CIA protection, to major figures in al-Qaeda. But also it was very conspicuous in the case of Qatar that one of the top people that the CIA were trying to get, the FBI, and the CIA, and the CIA agent went to Qatar to pick him up, but they had to notify the Qatar authorities, and the Qatar authorities told this, I think it was al-Zawahiri, I can't pronounce his name very well, but anyway, the Qatar Minister of the Interior told al-Zawahiri so that he could get out and not be picked up. And that's only just one example of a whole series. It takes me three or four chapters in my book to go through the whole long history of protection. Now, the big picture there, I think, is relatively easy to see, and that is that in the 80s, the big new frontier in oil exploration was Central Asia. And it was the CIA ambition to break up the Soviet Union, which they managed to do. And so you have a lot of new countries like Kazakhstan with oil reserves, and U.S. corporations like Chevron go in there and start developing them. But they're going to, you know, Kazakhstan is going to be very much in the Soviet or the Russian orbit, unless you have some balancing power there. And so there's a powerful motive to get U.S. troops into Uzbekistan, which we did, and eventually Afghanistan and even Tajikistan. There was a huge buildup of bases there, and you had this group called the Project for the New American Century, which was advocating a forward strategy, which they said you have to have these bases all over the world like this. Well, it was very good for the oil companies. Now, when we come to Syria, I once worked for John Kerry, and at the time I thought he was intelligent and progressive. He was exposing the drug trafficking that was connected with the Contra operation in Nicaragua. But recently, all this business about how Assad has to go. I mean, yes, as you said, we tried that in Libya. And, it's clear in the case of Libya, we diminished Russian influence. Libya was a state that was prepared to start selling oil outside of OPEC and in conjunction with the Russians. But it's been a terrible disaster and certainly contributed to the rise of terrorism. And if we get rid of Assad, which I hope we don't, frankly, now, because, you know, I'm a former diplomat. The only solution I see for this very, very dangerous situation in Syria is negotiation. And if America goes there and says, well, Assad has to go, you're not going to get productive negotiations with Iran and Russia, which we need to have. So I'm very upset, and I know you didn't want me to make too long an answer. You can interrupt me, but that's the gist of what I had to say.
Okay. What I see is this is the deep state at work. On the one hand, you have a whole group of people with the National Defense Intelligence Agency coming up with understanding that we shouldn't be in Afghanistan, we shouldn't be in Iraq. Saddam Hussein represented no threat, and yet their advice was not taken. They also did not want Libya attacked. They saw the consequences, because when Libya was attacked, it was the wealthiest country in Africa, the most educated population in Africa, the best rights for women in any country in Africa. They are the best healthcare system in Africa, the largest clean water aquifer built by Gaddafi in Africa. More of his wealth was shared with the, and I'm just saying he's a nice guy. He was a dictator, but
right.
He gave money.
Everything you say is true. Yes.
He also gave more money back to his citizens than any other person in the Middle East. He also gave $50,000 if you got married. He would take care of your medical care, even if you couldn't get an operation there and had to go to any hospital. He paid for the trip and your operation or your medicine. Anywhere you wanted to go in the world for your education, it was free. Now, we don't have that on any other place in the world, not even in Norway, which is now a basket case. But it was also at that time one of the most progressive countries in Africa. He wanted to change over the oil money and put it into the dinars. He wanted a gold back trading and go off the dollar as the measure of exchange, as
that's
did Saddam Hussein. And that they wouldn't allow to happen.
Right.
That's
and
what this was about.
Instead of, we don't have Gaddafi now, we have terrorists all through Africa, and we have AFRICOM, the U.S. Army in Africa, and I would like to think that America really didn't want to see these terrorists in Africa, but if you didn't have the terrorists, you wouldn't have AFRICOM. You wouldn't have the U.S. military presence. So I don't know what the thinking is there, but it's very clear to me that our main anti-terrorist strategies, the use of drones, things like that, they do kill terrorists, but they also create terrorists, and they probably create terrorists at a ratio of 10 to 1 or something like that. So it is an outrageously irrational policy that we're pursuing to fight terrorism in that area. The New York Times conceded in an article not long ago that the crucible that created ISIS was the fighting in Iraq that, of course, was started by the United States. So if we want to see less terrorism in that area, I think one of the first steps is to have less offensive U.S. action in that area. It's, a lot of people have said this, not just me. All kinds of terrorism experts are saying we're creating terrorists, we're at a faster rate than we're killing them, but it doesn't seem to change our policy.
Well, we also have to understand in the Middle East you have approximately 40 people per extended family. So in Iraq, when you displace 23 million people or adversely affect them, with 4 million being having to move within the country, sectarian violence where you're funding the people to do the sectarian violence to one another, you create a fractured state. And then the oil companies come in. And then the war profiteers come in. Then the reconstruction profiteers come in, where they get cost plus, and charge $100 to wash a duffel bag of clothes that would cost a quarter. And suddenly you have anywhere, depending upon Joseph Stiglitz's figures, $3 to $5 trillion. It's very profitable. So there's not going to be any stopping of anything. And the deep state knows that, even though those technocrats that oversee the bureaucrats within the federal agencies that tell the president and others what we should do, the president cannot listen to these people. Wilkerson was the chief of staff for Colin Powell, and he said very clearly that today he's embarrassed by what happened because the real intelligence agencies in the United States knew that there were no weapons of mass destruction. They knew that Curveball was a plant and was not credible. Right. They knew that the intelligence coming out of Cheney's office to the New York Times was circular. So the New York Times publishes a piece saying the sources say, then Cheney says, well, the New York Times says that there's weapons of mass destruction. Yeah, you clown, you gave it to them. And Judith Miller, who is now a celebrity on Fox Network, she's in there, and all of these clowns end up, Oliver North and the most embarrassing ambassador, in my opinion, in the history of America, if not the world, is, do you know who I'm talking about? Who would you say, he's got a Walrus mustache, who would you say is the most embarrassing neocon? I'm surprised he didn't come out in a caveman outfit with a sword.
You've got me guessing here. Who are you talking about?
Come on. Big, thick eyebrows, grayish hair, full head of hair, and he had a very short stint as an ambassador and uses that, and he's in with all these think tanks, and he's always on Fox, and he's so a supposed expert on this. He worked for Negroponte. He worked for Negroponte.
Yes. Right down in Honduras.
Yes. You'll think, I'm not going to tell you, you'll think of it in a moment. Anyhow, this, on the one hand, that's how millions of Americans get their so-called facts and information. The deep state people, the people who control their corporations, may not know each other, may not belong to the same club, but they're like a group of about 2,000 great white sharks looking for the nosebleed. And they find the nosebleed.
Yes, there is a feeding frenzy right now.
And they're the ones who dictate who gets elected, because no one in America gets elected before they're selected. And you don't get selected to anything in America unless you are going to give them 100 to 1,000 times back what they give you. And that's how it works. So that today represents, in my opinion, the deep state. And that's why we will not lift a finger to stop Saudi Arabia from beheading the leading Shia imam cleric in Iran, in Saudi Arabia. And you can kill politicians and get away with it in the Middle East. You can kill soldiers and citizens, get away with it. You never get away with killing that. Never. Mark my words. Iran and and Syria and Iraq are Shia against all the Sunnis, and watch what will happen. There won't be air wars. There won't be submarine wars. There won't be land wars. There'll be acts against their infrastructure, which is the oil. And when you go against the oil, watch what happens in Qatar, that has $188 billion in gross domestic product with a population of 1.6 million and no debt. Watch what happens when they can't pump oil. Watch in Saudi Arabia that had $900 billion. Now they're down to $600 billion, had to go on the market and borrow money, and the price of oil is going to stay around $34 to $36, and their infrastructure is so expensive that they cannot maintain this. They're going to have to spend a lot more money to keep themselves from being overthrown, and yet now they thought they had a two-week war, and it's 9 months in Yemen, and now the Yemenis are coming across the border and attacking their towns, and the enemy knows, strangle Saudi Arabia and those other Sunnis by going after their finances, by going after their oil. I'll bet anything that after the death of this Shia cleric, that you'll see a different strategy on the part of going after these countries that have not been attacked. Qatar hasn't been attacked. Kuwait hasn't been attacked, not since Saddam Hussein. and Saudi Arabia has not been attacked. Watch it all change, and then watch how many people are going to get into trouble within the royal family. Plus, the royal family is a divided, dysfunctional family anyhow, and the 31-year-old defense minister, whose father is the king, an absolute monarchy, they're hated within their own family structure. So the Middle East is going to be one giant cauldron of dysfunction, and we should pay attention because the worse it is...
It's actually started, I would say, for about a decade, we've had a Shia-Sunni war becoming more and more organized in various places, in Yemen, in Syria, in Iraq, of course, and it's going to get worse. It's the roots of it go back.
I agree.
At the beginning, I think America was in a position to control it. I think America has lost a good deal of its control now. The petrodollar link between Saudi Arabia and America is not what it was, because we are now exporting oil. And we haven't talked about gas, but gas is a slightly different thing, but also a very major factor in here. And one way to analyze Syria is a war between pipelines, what they call the Shia pipeline and the Sunni pipeline.
I absolutely agree. By the way, deep state, the big armaments industry, and the Wall Street banks backing them, they have made trillions of dollars out of these conflicts. What they haven't counted upon is what happened when the people like Saudi Arabia and these other countries that buy $60 billion a year in their armaments, when they're now out of power. And that's the next stage of this event, I believe, in the next 1 to 2 to 3 years. Thank you very much for being with us. We're out of time. Dr. Peter Dale Scott.
Thank you.
I'm Gary Nall. Thank you for listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour. Have a nice day.